beautiful relationship, so why are the old folks poking their noses into our business again? Fortunately, I'm used to hiding my feelings, so I manage not to show how crazy I am about him. Is he ever going to say anything? Am I ever going to feel his cheek against mine, the way I felt Peytel's cheek in my dream? Oh, Peter and Peytel, you're one and the same. They don't understand us. They'd never understand that we're content just to sit beside each other and not say a word. They have no idea of what draws us together. Oh, when will we overcome all these difficulties? And yet it's good that we have to surmount them, since it makes the end that much more beautiful. When he lays his head on his arms and closes his eyes, he's still a child. When he plays with Mushi or talks about her, he's loving. When he carries the potatoes or other heavy loads, he's strong. When he goes to watch the gunfire or walks through the dark house to look for burglars, he's brave. And when he's so awkward and clumsy, he's hopelessly endearing. It's much nicer when he explains something to me than when I have to teach him. I wish he were superior to me in nearly every way. What do we care about our tomb leathers? Oh, if only he'd say something. Father always says I'm conceited, but I'm not. I'm merely vain. I haven't had many people tell me I was pretty, except for a boy at school who said I looked so cute when I smiled. Yesterday, Peter paid me a true compliment, and just for fun, I'll give you a rough idea of our conversation. Peter often says, "Smile!" I thought it was strange, so yesterday I asked him, "Why do you always want me to smile?" "Because you get dimples in your cheeks. How do you do that?" "I was born with them. There's also one in my chin. It's the only mark of beauty I possess." "No, no, that's not true." "Yes, it is. I know I'm not beautiful. I never have been, and I never will be." "I don't agree. I think you're pretty." "I am not." "I say you are, and you'll have to take my word for it." So, of course, I then said the same about him. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, March 29th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Mr. Bolkestein, the cabinet minister, speaking on the Dutch broadcast from London, said that after the war, a collection would be made of diaries and letters dealing with the war. Of course, everyone pounced on my diary. Just imagine how interesting it would be if I were to publish a novel about the secret annex. The title alone would make people think it was a detective story. Seriously, though, 10 years after the war, people would find it very amusing to read how we lived, what we ate, and what we talked about as Jews in hiding. Although I tell you a great deal about our lives, you still know very little about us. How frightened the women are during air raids. Last Sunday, for instance, when 350 British planes dropped 550 tons of bombs on Imuda, so that the houses trembled like blades of grass in the wind. Or how many epidemics are raging here. You know nothing of these matters, and it would take me all day to describe everything down to the last detail. People have to stand in line to buy vegetables and all kinds of goods. Doctors can't visit their patients, since their cars and bikes are stolen the moment they turn their backs. Burglaries and thefts are so common that you ask yourself what's suddenly gotten into the Dutch to make them so light-fingered. Little children, 8 and 11-year-olds, smash the windows of people's homes and steal whatever they can lay their hands on. People don't dare leave the house for even 5 minutes, since they're liable to come back and find all their belongings gone. Every day, the newspapers are filled with reward notices for the return of stolen typewriters, Persian rugs, electric clocks, fabrics, etc. The electric clocks on street corners are dismantled. Public phones are stripped down to the last wire. Morale among the Dutch can't be good. Everyone's hungry. Except for the ersatz coffee, a week's food ration doesn't last 2 days. The invasion's long in coming. The men are being shipped off to Germany. The children are sick or undernourished. Everyone's wearing worn-out clothes and run-down shoes. A new sole costs 7.5 guilders on the black market. Besides, few shoemakers will do repairs, or if they do, you have to wait 4 months for your shoes, which might very well have disappeared in the meantime. One good thing has come out of this. As the food gets worse and the decrees more severe, the acts of sabotage against the authorities are increasing. The ration board, the police, the officials, they're all either helping their fellow citizens or denouncing them and sending them off to prison. Fortunately, Only a small percentage of Dutch people are on the wrong side. Yours, Anne. Friday, March 31st, 1944. Dearest Kitty, just imagine, it's still fairly cold and yet most people have been without coal for nearly a month. Sounds awful, doesn't it? There's a general mood of optimism about the Russian front, because that's going great guns. I don't often write about the political situation, but I must tell you where the Russians are at the moment. They've reached the Polish border and the Prut River in Romania. They're close to Odessa, and they've surrounded Ternopil. Every night we're expecting an extra communique from Stalin. They're firing off so many salutes in Moscow, the city must be rumbling and shaking all day long. Whether they like to pretend the fighting's nearby, or they simply don't have any other way to express their joy, I don't know. Hungary has been occupied by German troops. There are still a million Jews living there. They, too, are doomed. Nothing special is happening here. Today is Mr. Van Dan's birthday. He received 2 packets of tobacco, 1 serving of coffee, which his wife had managed to save, lemon punch from Mr. Kugler, sardines from Meep, eau de cologne from us, lilacs, tulips, and last but not least, a cake with raspberry filling, slightly gluey because of the poor quality of the flour and the lack of butter, but delicious anyway. All that talk about Peter and me has died down a bit. He's coming to pick me up tonight. Pretty nice of him, don't you think, since he hates doing it. We're very good friends. We spend a lot of time together and talk about every imaginable subject. It's so nice not having to hold back when we come to a delicate topic, the way I would with other boys. For example, we were talking about blood, and somehow the conversation turned to menstruation, etc. He thinks we women are quite tough to be able to withstand the loss of blood, and that I am too. I wonder why. My life here has gotten better, much better. God has not forsaken me, and he never will. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, April 1st, 1944. My dearest Kitty, and yet everything is still so difficult. You do know what I mean, don't you? I long so much for him to kiss me, but that kiss is taking its own sweet time. Does he still think of me as a friend? Don't I mean anything more? You and I both know that I'm strong, that I can carry most burdens alone. I've never been used to sharing my worries with anyone, and I've never clung to a mother, but I'd love to lay my head on his shoulder and just sit there quietly. I can't, I simply can't forget that dream of Peter's cheek when everything was so good. Does he have the same longing? Is he just too shy to say he loves me? Why does he want me near him so much? Oh, why doesn't he say something? I've got to stop. I've got to be calm. I'll try to be strong again, and if I'm patient, the rest will follow. But, and this is the worst part, I seem to be chasing him. I'm always the one who has to go upstairs. He never comes to me. But that's because of the rooms, and he understands why I object. Oh, I'm sure he understands more than I think. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, April 3rd, 1944. My dearest Kitty, contrary to my usual practice, I'm going to write you a detailed description of the food situation, since it's become a matter of some difficulty and importance, not only here in the Annex, but in all of Holland, all of Europe, and even beyond. In the 21 months we've lived here, we've been through a good many food cycles. You'll understand what that means in a moment. A food cycle is a period in which we have only one particular dish or type of vegetable to eat. For a long time, we ate nothing but endive. Endive with sand, endive without sand, endive with mashed potatoes, endive and mashed potato casserole. Then it was spinach, followed by kohlrabi, salsify, cucumbers, tomatoes, sauerkraut, etc., etc. It's not much fun when you have to eat, say, sauerkraut every day for lunch and dinner, but when you're hungry enough, you do a lot of things. Now, however, we're going through the most delightful period so far, because there are no vegetables at all. Our weekly lunch menu consists of brown beans, split pea soup, potatoes with dumplings, potato kugel, and, by the grace of God, turnip greens or rotten carrots. And then it's back to brown beans. Because of the bread shortage, we eat potatoes at every meal, starting with breakfast, but then we fry them a little. To make soup, we use brown beans, navy beans, potatoes, packages of vegetable soup, packages of chicken soup, and packages of bean soup. There are brown beans in everything, including the bread. For dinner, we always have potatoes with imitation gravy and, thank goodness, we've still got it, beet salad. I must tell you about the dumplings. We make them with government-issue flour, water, and yeast. They're so gluey and tough that it feels as if you have rocks in your stomach, but oh well. The high point is our weekly slice of liverwurst and the jam on our unbuttered bread. But we're still alive, and much of the time, it still tastes good, too. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, April 5th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, for a long time now, I didn't know why I was bothering to do any schoolwork. The end of the war still seemed so far away, so unreal, like a fairy tale. If the war isn't over by September, I won't go back to school, since I don't want to be 2 years behind. Peter filled my days. Nothing but Peter. Dreams and thoughts until Saturday night, when I felt so utterly miserable. Oh, it was awful. I held back my tears when I was with Peter, laughed uproariously with the Van Dans as we drank lemon punch and was cheerful and excited. But the minute I was alone, I knew I was going to cry my eyes out. I slid to the floor in my nightgown and began by saying my prayers, very fervently. Then I drew my knees to my chest, laid my head on my arms, and cried, all huddled up on the bare floor. A loud sob brought me back down to earth, and I choked back my tears, since I didn't want anyone next door to hear me. Then I tried to pull myself together, saying over and over, I must, I must, I must. Stiff from sitting in such an unusual position, I fell back against the side of the bed and kept up my struggle until just before 10:30, when I climbed back into bed. It was over. And now it's really over. I finally realized that I must do my schoolwork to keep from being ignorant, to get on in life, to become a journalist, because that's what I want. I know I can write. A few of my stories are good. My descriptions of the secret annex are humorous. Much of my diary is vivid and alive. But it remains to be seen whether I really have talent. Ava's Dream is my best fairy tale. And the odd thing is that I don't have the faintest idea where it came from. Parts of Katie's life are also good, but as a whole, it's nothing special. I'm my best and harshest critic. I know what's good and what isn't. Unless you write yourself, you can't know how wonderful it is. I always used to bemoan the fact that I couldn't draw, but now I'm overjoyed that at least I can write. And if I don't have the talent to write books or newspaper articles, I can always write for myself. But I want to achieve more than that. I can't imagine having to live like Mother, Mrs. Van Dan, and all the women who go about their work and are then forgotten. I need to have something besides a husband and children to devote myself to. I don't want to have lived in vain like most people. I want to be useful or bring enjoyment to all people, even those I've never met. I want to go on living even after my death, and that's why I'm so grateful to God for having given me this gift, which I can use to develop myself and to express all that's inside me. When I write, I can shake off all my cares. My sorrow disappears. My spirits are revived. But, and that's a big question, will I ever be able to write something great? Will I ever become a journalist or a writer? I hope so. Oh, I hope so very much, because writing allows me to record everything, all my thoughts, ideals, and fantasies. I haven't worked on Katie's life for ages. In my mind, I've worked out exactly what happens next, but the story doesn't seem to be coming along very well. I might never finish it, and it'll wind up in the waste paper basket or the stove. That's a horrible thought. But then I say to myself, at the age of 14, and with so little experience, you can't write about philosophy. So, onward and upward with renewed spirits. It'll all work out, because I'm determined to write. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Thursday, April 6th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, You asked me what my hobbies and interests are, and I'd like to answer, but I'd better warn you, I have lots of them, so don't be surprised. First of all, writing, but I don't really think of that as a hobby. Number two, genealogical charts. I'm looking in every newspaper, book, and document I can find for the family trees of the French, German, Spanish, English, Austrian, Russian, Norwegian, and Dutch royal families. I've made great progress with many of them, because for a long time I've been taking notes while reading biographies or history books. I even copy out many of the passages on history. So my third hobby is history, and Father's already bought me numerous books. I can hardly wait for the day when I'll be able to go to the public library and ferret out the information I need. Number four is Greek and Roman mythology. I have various books on this subject, too. I can name the nine muses and the seven loves of Zeus. I have the wives of Hercules, etc., etc., down pat. My other hobbies are movie stars and family photographs. I'm crazy about reading and books. I adore the history of the arts, especially when it concerns writers, poets, and painters. Musicians may come later. I loathe algebra, geometry, and arithmetic. I enjoy all my other school subjects, but history is my favorite. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, April 11th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, my head's in a whirl. I really don't know where to begin. Thursday, the last time I wrote you, everything was as usual. Friday afternoon, Good Friday, we played Monopoly. Saturday afternoon, too. The days passed very quickly. Around 2 o'clock on Saturday, heavy firing began. Machine guns, according to the men. For the rest, everything was quiet. Sunday afternoon, Peter came to see me at 4:30 at my invitation. At 5:15, we went to the front attic, where we stayed until 6. There was a beautiful Mozart concert on the radio from 6 to 7:15. I especially enjoyed the Kleine Nacht music. I can hardly bear to listen in the kitchen, since beautiful music stirs me to the very depths of my soul. Sunday evening, Peter couldn't take his bath because the wash tub was down in the office kitchen, filled with laundry. The two of us went to the front attic together, and in order to be able to sit comfortably, I took along the only cushion I could find in my room. We seated ourselves on a packing crate. Since both the crate and the cushion were very narrow, we were sitting quite close, leaning against two other crates. Mushi kept us company, so we weren't without a chaperone. Suddenly, at 9:15, Mr. Van Dan whistled and asked if we had Mr. Dussel's cushion. We jumped up and went downstairs with the cushion, the cat, and Mr. Van Dan. This cushion was the source of much misery. Dussel was angry because I'd taken the one he uses as a pillow, and he was afraid it might be covered with fleas. He had the entire house in an uproar because of this one cushion. In revenge, Peter and I stuck two hard brushes in his bed, but had to take them out again when Dussel unexpectedly decided to go sit in his room. We had a really good laugh at this little intermezzo. But our fun was short-lived. At 9:30, Peter knocked gently on the door and asked Father to come upstairs and help him with a difficult English sentence. "That sounds fishy," I said to Margot. "It's obviously a pretext. You can tell by the way the men are talking that there's been a break-in." I was right. The warehouse was being broken into at that very moment. Father, Mr. Van Dan, and Peter were downstairs in a flash. Margot, Mother, Mrs. Vandy, and I waited. Four frightened women need to talk, so that's what we did until we heard a bang downstairs. After that, all was quiet. The clock struck 9:45. The color had drained from our faces, but we remained calm, even though we were afraid. Where were the men? What was that bang? Were they fighting with the burglars? We were too scared to think. All we could do was wait. 10 o'clock, footsteps on the stairs. Father, pale and nervous, came inside, followed by Mr. Van Dan. "Lights out! Tiptoe upstairs. We're expecting the police." There wasn't time to be scared. The lights were switched off, I grabbed a jacket, and we sat down upstairs. "What happened? Tell us quickly!" There was no one to tell us. The men had gone back downstairs. The four of them didn't come back up until 10:10. Two of them kept watch at Peter's open window. The door to the landing was locked, the bookcase shut. We draped a sweater over our nightlight, and then they told us what had happened. Peter was on the landing when he heard two loud bangs. He went downstairs and saw that a large panel was missing from the left half of the warehouse door. He dashed upstairs, alerted the home guard, and the four of them went downstairs. When they entered the warehouse, the burglars were going about their business. Without thinking, Mr. Van Dan yelled, "Police!" Hurried footsteps outside. The burglars had fled. The board was put back in the door so the police wouldn't notice the gap, but then a swift kick from outside sent it flying to the floor. The men were amazed at the burglars' audacity. Both Peter and Mr. Van Dan felt a murderous rage come over them. Mr. Van Dan slammed an axe against the floor, and all was quiet again. Once more the panel was replaced, and once more the attempt was foiled. Outside, a man and a woman shone a glaring flashlight through the opening, lighting up the entire warehouse. "What the?" mumbled one of the men. But now the rules had been reversed. Instead of policemen, they were now burglars. All four of them raced upstairs. Dussel and Mr. Van Dan snatched up Dussel's books. Peter opened the doors and windows in the kitchen and private office, hurled the phone to the ground, and the four of them finally ended up behind the bookcase. End of part one. In all probability, the man and woman with the flashlight had alerted the police. It was Sunday night, Easter Sunday. The next day, Easter Monday, the office was going to be closed, which meant we wouldn't be able to move around until Tuesday morning. Think of it, having to sit in such terror for a day and two nights. We thought of nothing, but simply sat there in pitch darkness. In her fear, Mrs. Van Dee had switched off the lamp. We whispered, and every time we heard a creak, someone said, "Shh, shh." It was 10:30, then 11. Not a sound. Father and Mr. Van Dan took turns coming upstairs to us. Then, at 11:15, a noise below. Up above, you could hear the whole family breathing. For the rest, no one moved a muscle. Footsteps in the house, the private office, the kitchen, then on the staircase. All sounds of breathing stopped. Eight hearts pounded. Footsteps on the stairs, then a rattling at the bookcase. This moment is indescribable. "Now we're done for," I said, and I had visions of all 15 of us being dragged away by the Gestapo that very night. More rattling at the bookcase, twice. Then we heard a can fall, and the footsteps receded. We were out of danger, so far. A shiver went through everyone's body. I heard several sets of teeth chattering. No one said a word. We stayed like this until 11:30. There were no more sounds in the house, but a light was shining on our landing, right in front of the bookcase. Was that because the police thought it looked so suspicious, or because they simply forgot? Was anyone going to come back and turn it off? We found our tongues again. There were no longer any people inside the building, but perhaps someone was standing guard outside. We then did three things. Tried to guess what was going on, trembled with fear, and went to the bathroom. Since the buckets were in the attic, all we had was Peter's metal waste paper basket. Mr. Van Dan went first, then Father, but Mother was too embarrassed. Father brought the waste basket to the next room, where Margot, Mrs. Van Dan, and I gratefully made use of it. Mother finally gave in. There was a great demand for paper, and luckily I had some in my pocket. The waste basket stank. Everything went on in a whisper, and we were exhausted. It was midnight. "Lie down on the floor and go to sleep." Margot and I were each given a pillow and a blanket. Margot lay down near the foot cupboard, and I made my bed between the table legs. The smell wasn't quite so bad when you were lying on the floor, but Mrs. Van Dan quietly went and got some powdered bleach and draped a dish towel over the potty as a further precaution. Talk, whispers, fear, stench, farting, and people continually going to the bathroom. Try sleeping through that. By 2:30, however, I was so tired I dozed off and didn't hear a thing until 3:30. I woke up when Mrs. Van Dee laid her head on my feet. "For heaven's sake, give me something to put on," I said. I was handed some clothes, but don't ask what. A pair of wool slacks over my pajamas, a red sweater and a black skirt, white understockings, and tattered knee socks. Mrs. Van Dee sat back down on the chair, and Mr. Van Dee lay down with his head on my feet. From 3:30 onward, I was engrossed in thought, and still shivering so much that Mr. Van Dan couldn't sleep. I was preparing myself for the return of the police. We'd tell them we were in hiding. If they were good people, we'd be safe. And if they were Nazi sympathizers, we could try to bribe them. "We should hide the radio," moaned Mrs. Vandy.
"Sure. In the stove," answered Mr. Vandy. "If they find us, they might as well find the radio."
"Then they'll also find Anne's diary," added Father.
"So burn it," suggested the most terrified of the group.
This and the police rattling on the bookcase were the moments when I was most afraid. Oh, not my diary. If my diary goes, I go too. Thank goodness Father didn't say anything more. There's no point in recounting all the conversations. So much was said. I comforted Mrs. Van Dan, who was very frightened. We talked about escaping, being interrogated by the Gestapo, phoning Mr. Kleiman, and being courageous. "We must behave like soldiers, Mrs. Van Dan. If our time has come, well, then it'll be for Queen and country. For freedom, truth, and justice, as they're always telling us on the radio. The only bad thing is that we'll drag the others down with us." After an hour, Mr. Van Dan switched places with his wife again, and Father came and sat beside me. The men smoked one cigarette after another. An occasional sigh was heard. Somebody made another trip to the potty, and then everything began all over again. 4 o'clock, 5, 5:30. I went and sat with Peter by his window and listened. So close we could feel each other's bodies trembling. We spoke a word or two from time to time and listened intently. Next door they took down the blackout screen. They made a list of everything they were planning to tell Mr. Kleiman over the phone, because they intended to call him at 7 and ask him to send someone over. They were taking a big chance, since the police guard at the door or in the warehouse might hear them calling. But there was an even greater risk that the police would return. I'm enclosing their list, but for the sake of clarity, I'll copy it here. Burglary. Police in building, up to bookcase, but no farther. Burglars apparently interrupted, forced warehouse door, fled through garden. Main entrance bolted. Kugler must have left through second door. Typewriter and adding machine safe in black chest in private office. Meeps or Bep's laundry in washtub and kitchen. Only Bep or Kugler have key to second door. Lock may be broken. Try to warn Jan and get key. Look around office. Also feed cat. For the rest, everything went according to plan. Mr. Kleiman was phoned. The poles were removed from the doors. The typewriter was put back in the chest. Then we all sat around the table again and waited for either Jan or the police. Peter had dropped off to sleep, and Mr. Van Dan and I were lying on the floor when we heard loud footsteps below. I got up quietly.
"It's Jan!"
"No, no, it's the police," they all said. There was a knocking at our bookcase. Meep whistled. This was too much for Mrs. Van Dan, who sank limply in her chair, white as a sheet. If the tension had lasted another minute, she would have fainted. Jan and Meep came in and were met with a delightful scene. The table alone would have been worth a photograph. A copy of Cinema and Theater, open to a page of dancing girls and smeared with jam and pectin, which we'd been taking to combat the diarrhea. 2 jam jars, half a bread roll, a quarter of a bread roll, pectin, a mirror, a comb, matches, ashes, cigarettes, tobacco, an ashtray, books, a pair of underpants, a flashlight, Mrs. Van Dan's comb, toilet paper, etc. Jan and Meep were, of course, greeted with shouts and tears. Jan nailed a pinewood board over the gap in the door and went off again with Meep to inform the police of the break-in. Meep had also found a note under the warehouse door from Slagers, the night watchman, who had noticed the hole and alerted the police. Jan was also planning to see Slagers. So we had half an hour in which to put the house and ourselves to rights. I've never seen such a transformation as in those 30 minutes. Margot and I got the beds ready downstairs, went to the bathroom, brushed our teeth, washed our hands, and combed our hair. Then I straightened up the room a bit and went back upstairs. The table had already been cleared, so we got some water, made coffee and tea, boiled the milk, and set the table. Father and Peter emptied our improvised potties and rinsed them with warm water and powdered bleach. The largest one was filled to the brim and was so heavy they had a hard time lifting it. To make things worse, it was leaking, so they had to put it in a bucket. At 11 o'clock, Jan was back and joined us at the table,
and gradually everyone began to relax. Jan had the following story to tell. Mr. Slagers was asleep, but his wife told Jan that her husband had discovered the hole in the door while making his rounds. He called in a policeman, and the two of them searched the building. Mr. Slagers, in his capacity as night watchman, patrols the area every night on his bike, accompanied by his two dogs. His wife said that he would come on Tuesday and tell Mr. Kugler the rest. No one at the police station seemed to know anything about the break-in, but they made a note to come first thing Tuesday morning to have a look. On the way back, Jan happened to run into Mr. Van Hoven, the man who supplies us with potatoes, and told him of the break-in. "I know," Mr. Van Hoven calmly replied. "Last night when my wife and I were walking past your building, I saw a gap in the door. My wife wanted to walk on, but I peeked inside with a flashlight, and that's when the burglars must have run off. To be on the safe side, I didn't call the police. I thought it wouldn't be wise in your case. I don't know anything, but I have my suspicions." Jan thanked him and went on. Mr. Van Hoven obviously suspects we're here, because he always delivers the potatoes at lunchtime. A decent man. It was 1 o'clock by the time Jan left, and we'd done the dishes. All eight of us went to bed. I woke up at 2:45 and saw that Mr. Dussel was already up. My face rumpled with sleep, I happened to run into Peter in the bathroom just after he'd come downstairs. We agreed to meet in the office. I freshened up a bit and went down. "After all this, do you still dare go to the front attic?" he asked. I nodded, grabbed my pillow, with a cloth wrapped around it, and we went up together. The weather was gorgeous, and even though the air raid sirens soon began to wail, we stayed where we were. Peter put his arm around my shoulder, I put mine around his, and we sat quietly like this until 4 o'clock, when Margot came to get us for coffee. We ate our bread, drank our lemonade, and joked. We're finally able to again, and for the rest, everything was back to normal. That evening I thanked Peter because he'd been the bravest of us all. None of us have ever been in such danger as we were that night. God was truly watching over us. Just think, the police were right at the bookcase. The light was on, and still no one had discovered our hiding place. "Now we're done for," I'd whispered at that moment. But once again, we were spared. When the invasion comes and the bombs start falling, it'll be every man for himself. But this time we feared for those good, innocent Christians who are helping us. "We've been saved. Keep on saving us. That's all we can say." This incident has brought about a whole lot of changes. As of now, Dussel will be doing his work in the bathroom, and Peter will be patrolling the house between 8:30 and 9:30. Peter isn't allowed to open his window anymore, since one of the keg people noticed it was open. We can no longer flush the toilet after 9:30 at night. Mr. Slagers has been hired as night watchman. And tonight a carpenter from the underground is coming to make a barricade out of our white Frankfurt bedsteads. Debates are going on left and right in the annex. Mr. Kugler has reproached us for our carelessness. Jan also said we should never go downstairs. What we have to do now is find out whether Slagers can be trusted, whether the dogs will bark if they hear someone behind the door, how to make the barricade, all sorts of things. We've been strongly reminded of the fact that we're Jews in chains, chained to one spot, without any rights, but with 1,000 obligations. We must put our feelings aside. We must be brave and strong, bear discomfort without complaint, do whatever is in our power, and trust in God. One day this terrible war will be over. The time will come when we'll be people again and not just Jews. Who has inflicted this on us? Who has set us apart from all the rest? Who has put us through such suffering? It's God who has made us the way we are, but it's also God who will lift us up again. In the eyes of the world, we're doomed, but if, after all this suffering, there are still Jews left, the Jewish people will be held up as an example. Who knows? Maybe our religion will teach the world and all the people in it about goodness, and that's the reason, the only reason, we have to suffer. We can never be just Dutch, or just English, or whatever. We will always be Jews as well, and we'll have to keep on being Jews, but then we'll want to be. Be brave. Let's remember our duty and perform it without complaint. There will be a way out. God has never deserted our people. Through the ages, Jews have had to suffer, but through the ages, they've gone on living, and the centuries of suffering have only made them stronger. The weak shall fall, and the strong shall survive and not be defeated. That night, I really thought I was going to die. I waited for the police, and I was ready for death, like a soldier on a battlefield. I'd gladly have given my life for my country. But now that I've been spared, my first wish after the war is to become a Dutch citizen. I love the Dutch. I love this country. I love the language, and I want to work here. And even if I have to write to the Queen herself, I won't give up until I've reached my goal. I'm becoming more and more independent of my parents. Young as I am, I face life with more courage and have a better and truer sense of justice than Mother. I know what I want. I have a goal. I have opinions, a religion, and love. If only I can be myself, I'll be satisfied. I know that I'm a woman with inner strength and a great deal of courage. If God lets me live, I'll achieve more than Mother ever did. I'll make my voice heard. I'll go out into the world and work for mankind. I now know that courage and happiness are needed first. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, April 14th, 1944. Dear Kitty, everyone here is still very tense. Pim has nearly reached the boiling point. Mrs. Vandy is lying in bed with a cold, grumbling. Mr. Vandy is growing pale without his cigarettes. Dussel, who's having to give up many of his comforts, is carping at everyone, etc., etc. We seem to have run out of luck lately. The toilet's leaking and the faucet's stuck. Thanks to our many connections, we'll soon be able to get these repaired. I'm occasionally sentimental, as you know, but from time to time I have reason to be. When Peter and I are sitting close together on a hard wooden crate among the junk and dust, our arms around each other's shoulders, Peter toying with a lock of my hair, when the birds outside are trilling their songs, when the trees are in bud, when the sun beckons and the sky is so blue, oh, that's when I wish for so much. All I see around me are dissatisfied and grumpy faces. All I hear are sighs and stifled complaints. You'd think our lives had taken a sudden turn for the worse. Honestly, things are only as bad as you make them. Here in the annex, no one even bothers to set a good example. We each have to figure out how to get the better of our own moods. Every day you hear, "If only it were all over." Work, love, courage, and hope. Make me good and help me cope. I really believe, Kit, that I'm a little nutty today, and I don't know why. My writing's all mixed up. I'm jumping from one thing to another, and sometimes I seriously doubt whether anyone will ever be interested in this drivel. They'll probably call it the musings of an ugly duckling. My diaries certainly won't be of much use to Mr. Bolkestein or Mr. Gerbrandy. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Saturday, April 15th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, there's just one bad thing after another. When will it all end? You can sure say that again. Guess what's happened now? Peter forgot to unbolt the front door. As a result, Mr. Kugler and the warehouse employees couldn't get in. He went to kegs, smashed in our office kitchen window, and got in that way. The windows in the annex were open, and the keg people saw that, too. What must they be thinking? Anne Van Maren. Mr. Kugler's furious. We accuse him of not doing anything to reinforce the doors, and then we do a stupid thing like this. Peter's extremely upset. At the table, Mother said she felt more sorry for Peter than for anyone else, and he nearly began to cry. We're equally to blame, since we usually ask him every day if he's unbolted the door, and so does Mr. Van Dan. Maybe I can go comfort him later on. I want to help him so much. Here are the latest news bulletins about life in the secret annex over the last few weeks. A week ago, on Saturday, Bosch suddenly got sick. He sat quite still and started drooling. Meep immediately picked him up, rolled him in a towel, tucked him in her shopping bag, and brought him to the dog and cat clinic. Bosch had some kind of intestinal problem, so the vet gave him medicine. Peter gave it to him a few times, but Bosch soon made himself scarce. I'll bet he was out courting his sweetheart. but now his nose is swollen and he meows whenever you pick him up. He was probably trying to steal food and somebody smacked him. Mushi lost her voice for a few days. Just when we decided she had to be taken to the vet, too, she started getting better. We now leave the attic window open a crack every night. Peter and I often sit up there in the evening. Thanks to rubber cement and oil paint, our toilet could quickly be repaired. The broken faucet has been replaced. Luckily, Mr. Kleiman is feeling better. He's going to see a specialist soon. We can only hope he won't need an operation. This month, we received 8 ration books. Unfortunately, for the next 2 weeks, beans have been substituted for oatmeal or groats. Our latest delicacy is piccalilli. If you're out of luck, all you get is a jar full of cucumber and mustard sauce. Vegetables are hard to come by. There's only lettuce, lettuce, and more lettuce. Our meals consist entirely of potatoes and imitation gravy. The Russians are in possession of more than half the Crimea. The British aren't advancing beyond Casino. We'll have to count on the Western Wall. There have been a lot of unbelievably heavy air raids. The registry of births, deaths, and marriages in The Hague was bombed. All Dutch people will be issued new ration registration cards. Enough for today. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Sunday, April 16th, 1944. My dearest Kitty, remember yesterday's date, since it was a red-letter day for me. Isn't it an important day for every girl when she gets her first kiss? Well then, it's no less important to me. The time Brom kissed me on my right cheek, or Mr. Voudstra on my right hand, doesn't count. How did I suddenly come by this kiss? I'll tell you. Last night at 8, I was sitting with Peter on his divan, and it wasn't long before he put an arm around me. Since it was Saturday, he wasn't wearing his overalls. "Why don't we move over a little?" I said, "so I won't keep bumping my head against the cupboard." He moved so far over he was practically in the corner. I slipped my arm under his and across his back, and he put his arm around my shoulder so that I was nearly engulfed by him. We've sat like this on other occasions, but never so close as we were last night. He held me firmly against him, my left side against his chest. My heart had already begun to beat faster, but there was more to come. He wasn't satisfied until my head lay on his shoulder, with his on top of mine. I sat up again after about 5 minutes, but before long he took my head in his hands and put it back next to his. Oh, it was so wonderful. I could hardly talk. My pleasure was too intense. He caressed my cheek and arm, a bit clumsily, and played with my hair. Most of the time our heads were touching. I can't tell you, Kitty, the feeling that ran through me. I was too happy for words, and I think he was too. At 9:30, we stood up. Peter put on his tennis shoes so he wouldn't make much noise on his nightly round of the building, and I was standing next to him. How I suddenly made the right movement, I don't know, but before we went downstairs, he gave me a kiss. Through my hair, half on my left cheek and half on my ear. I tore downstairs without looking back, and I longed so much for today. Sunday morning, just before 11. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Monday, April 17th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, do you think father and mother would approve of a girl my age sitting on a divan and kissing a 17-and-a-half-year-old boy? I doubt they would, but I have to trust my own judgment in this matter. It's so peaceful and safe, lying in his arms and dreaming. It's so thrilling to feel his cheek against mine. It's so wonderful to know there's someone waiting for me. But, and there is a but, will Peter want to leave it at that? I haven't forgotten his promise, but he is a boy. I know I'm starting at a very young age, not even 15 and already so independent. That's a little hard for other people to understand. I'm pretty sure Margot would never kiss a boy unless there was some talk of an engagement or marriage. Neither Peter nor I have any such plans. I'm also sure that Mother never touched a man before she met Father. What would my girlfriends or Jacques say if they knew I'd lain in Peter's arms, with my heart against his chest, my head on his shoulder, and his head and face against mine? Oh, Anne, how terribly shocking! But seriously, I don't think it's at all shocking. We're cooped up here, cut off from the world, anxious and fearful, especially lately. Why should we stay apart when we love each other? Why shouldn't we kiss each other in times like these? Why should we wait until we've reached a suitable age? Why should we ask anybody's permission? I've decided to look out for my own interests. He'd never want to hurt me or make me unhappy. Why shouldn't I do what my heart tells me and makes both of us happy? Yet I have a feeling, Kitty, that you can sense my doubt. It must be my honesty rising in revolt against all this sneaking around. Do you think it's my duty to tell Father what I'm up to? Do you think our secret should be shared with a third person? Much of the beauty would be lost, but would it make me feel better inside? I'll bring it up with him. Oh, yes, I still have so much I want to discuss with him, since I don't see the point of just cuddling. Sharing our thoughts with each other requires a great deal of trust, but we'll both be stronger because of it. Yours, Anne M. Frank. P.S. We were up at 6 yesterday morning because the whole family heard the sounds of a break-in again. It must have been one of our neighbors who was the victim this time. When we checked at 7 o'clock, our doors were still shut tight. Thank goodness. Tuesday, April 18th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, everything's fine here. Last night, the carpenter came again to put some sheets of iron over the door panels. Father just got through saying he definitely expects large-scale operations in Russia and Italy, as well as in the West, before May 20th. The longer the war lasts, the harder it is to imagine being liberated from this place. Yesterday, Peter and I finally got around to having the talk we've been postponing for the last 10 days. I told him all about girls, without hesitating to discuss the most intimate matters. I found it rather amusing that he thought the opening in a woman's body was simply left out of illustrations. He couldn't imagine that it was actually located between a woman's legs. The evening ended with a mutual kiss, near the mouth. It's really a lovely feeling. I might take my favorite quotes notebook up with me sometime so Peter and I can go into things more deeply. I don't think lying in each other's arms day in and day out is very satisfying, and I hope he feels the same. After our mild winter, we've been having a beautiful spring. April is glorious, not too hot and not too cold, with occasional light showers. Our chestnut tree is in leaf, and here and there you can already see a few small blossoms. Bep presented us Saturday with 4 bouquets of flowers, 3 bouquets of daffodils, and 1 bouquet of grape hyacinths for me. Mr. Kugler is supplying us with more and more newspapers. It's time to do my algebra, Kitty. Bye. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Wednesday, April 19th, 1944. Dearest Darling. That's the title of a movie with Dorit Greisler, Ida Woost, and Harald Paulson. What could be nicer than sitting before an open window, enjoying nature, listening to the birds sing, feeling the sun on your cheeks, and holding a darling boy in your arms? I feel so peaceful and safe with his arm around me, knowing he's near and yet not having to speak. How can this be bad when it does me so much good? Oh, if only we were never disturbed again, not even by Mushi. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, April 21st, 1944. My dearest Kitty, I stayed in bed yesterday with a sore throat, but since I was already bored the very first afternoon and didn't have a fever, I got up today. My sore throat has nearly verschwunden. Yesterday, as you've probably already discovered, was our Führer's 55th birthday. Today is the 18th birthday of Her Royal Highness Princess Elizabeth of York. The BBC reported that she hasn't yet been declared of age, though royal children usually are. We've been wondering which prince they'll marry this beauty off to, but can't think of a suitable candidate. Perhaps her sister, Princess Margaret Rose, can have Crown Prince Baudouin of Belgium. Here we've been going from one disaster to the next. No sooner have the outside doors been reinforced than Van Maren rears his head again. In all likelihood, he's the one who stole the potato flour, and now he's trying to pin the blame on Bep. Not surprisingly, the annex is once again in an uproar. Bep is beside herself with rage. Perhaps Mr. Kugler will finally have this shady character tailed. The appraiser from Beethovenstraat was here this morning. He offered us 400 guilders for our chest. In our opinion, the other estimates are also too low. I want to ask the magazine, The Prince, if they'll take one of my fairy tales, under a pseudonym, of course. But up to now, all my fairy tales have been too long, so I don't think I have much of a chance. Until the next time, darling. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Tuesday, April 25th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, for the last 10 days, Dussel hasn't been on speaking terms with Mr. Van Dan, and all because of the new security measures since the break-in. One of these was that he's no longer allowed to go downstairs in the evenings. Peter and Mr. Van Dan make the last round every night at 9:30, and after that no one may go downstairs. We can't flush the toilet anymore after 8 at night or after 8 in the morning. The windows may be opened only in the morning when the lights go on in Mr. Kugler's office, and they can no longer be propped open with a stick at night. This last measure is the reason for Dussel's sulking. He claims that Mr. Van Dan bawled him out, but he has only himself to blame. He says he'd rather live without food than without air, and that they simply must figure out a way to keep the windows open. "I'll have to speak to Mr. Kugler about this," he said to me. I replied that we never discussed matters of this sort with Mr. Kugler, only within the group. "Everything's always happening behind my back. I'll have to talk to your father about that." He's also not allowed to sit in Mr. Kugler's office anymore on Saturday afternoons or Sundays, because the manager of Kegs might hear him if he happens to be next door. Dussel promptly went and sat there anyway. Mr. Van Dan was furious, and Father went downstairs to talk to Dussel, who came up with some flimsy excuse, but even Father didn't fall for it this time. Now Father's keeping his dealings with Dussel to a minimum, because Dussel insulted him. Not one of us knows what he said, but it must have been pretty awful. And to think that that miserable man has his birthday next week. How can you celebrate your birthday when you've got the sulks? How can you accept gifts from people you won't even talk to? Mr. Foskell is going downhill rapidly. For more than 10 days, he's had a temperature of almost 104. The doctor said his condition is hopeless. They think the cancer has spread to his lungs. The poor man. We'd so like to help him, but only God can help him now. I've written an amusing story called Blurry the Explorer, which was a big hit with my 3 listeners. I still have a bad cold and have passed it on to Margot, as well as Mother and Father. If only Peter doesn't get it. He insisted on a kiss and called me his El Dorado. You can't call a person that, silly boy. But he's sweet anyway. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Thursday, April 27th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, Mrs. Van D was in a bad mood this morning. All she did was complain, first about her cold, not being able to get cough drops, and the agony of having to blow her nose all the time. Next, she grumbled that the sun wasn't shining, the invasion hadn't started, we weren't allowed to look out the windows, etc., etc. We couldn't help but laugh at her, and it couldn't have been that bad, since she soon joined in. Our recipe for potato kugel modified due to lack of onions. Put peeled potatoes through a food mill and add a little dry government-issue flour and salt. Grease a mold or oven-proof dish with paraffin or stearin and bake for 2.5 hours. Serve with rotten strawberry compote. Onions not available, nor oil for mold or dough. At the moment, I'm reading Emperor Charles V, written by a professor at the University of Göttingen. He spent 40 years working on this book. It took me 5 days to read 50 pages. I can't do any more than that. Since the book has 598 pages, you can figure out just how long it's going to take me. And that's not even counting the second volume, but very interesting. The things a schoolgirl has to do in the course of a single day. Take me, for example. First, I translated a passage on Nelson's last battle from Dutch into English. Then I read more about the Northern War, 1700 to 1721, involving Peter the Great, Charles the XII, Augustus the Strong, Stanislaus Leszczynski, Mazeppa, von Goertz, Brandenburg, Western Pomerania, Eastern Pomerania, and Denmark, plus the usual dates. Next, I wound up in Brazil, where I read about Bahia tobacco, the abundance of coffee, the 1.5 million inhabitants of Rio de Janeiro, Pernambuco, and Sao Paulo, and, last but not least, the Amazon River. Then about Negroes, mulattoes, mestizos, whites, the illiteracy rate, over 50%, and malaria. Since I had some time left, I glanced through a genealogical chart. John the Old, William Louis, Ernest Casimir I, Henry Casimir I, right up to little Margaret Francisca, born in 1943 in Ottawa. 12 o'clock, I resumed my studies in the attic, reading about deans, priests, ministers, popes, and, whew, it was 1 o'clock. At 2, the poor child, ho-hum, was back at work. Old World and New World monkeys were next. Kitty, tell me quickly, how many toes does a hippopotamus have? Then came the Bible, Noah's Ark, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. After that, Charles V. Then, with Peter, Thackeray's book about the colonel, in English. A French test, and then a comparison between the Mississippi and the Missouri. Enough for today. Adieu. Yours, Anne M. Frank. Friday, April 28th, 1944. Dearest Kitty, I've never forgotten my dream of Peter Schiff, see the beginning of January. Even now, I can still feel his cheek against mine, and that wonderful glow that made up for all the rest. Once in a while, I'd had the same feeling with this Peter, but never so intensely. Until last night. We were sitting on the divan, as usual, in each other's arms. Suddenly, the everyday Anne slipped away, and the second Anne took her place. The second Anne, who's never overconfident or amusing, but wants only to love and be gentle. I sat pressed against him and felt a wave of emotion come over me. Tears rushed to my eyes. Those from the left fell on his overalls, while those from the right trickled down my nose and into the air and landed beside the first. Did he notice? He made no movement to show that he had. Did he feel the same way I did? He hardly said a word. Did he realize he had two Annes at his side? My questions went unanswered. At 8:30, I stood up and went to the window, where we always say goodbye. I was still trembling. I was still Anne number two. He came over to me, and I threw my arms around his neck and kissed him on his left cheek. I was about to kiss the other cheek when my mouth met his, and we pressed our lips together. In a daze, we embraced, over and over again, never to stop. Oh! Peter needs tenderness. For the first time in his life, he's discovered a girl. For the first time, he's seen that even the biggest pests also have an inner self and a heart, and are transformed as soon as they're alone with you. For the first time in his life, he's given himself and his friendship to another person. He's never had a friend before, boy or girl. Now we've found each other. I, for that matter, didn't know him either, and never had someone I could confide in. And it's led to this. The same question keeps nagging me. Is it right? Is it right for me to yield so soon, for me to be so passionate, to be filled with as much passion and desire as Peter? Can I, a girl, allow myself to go that far? There's only one possible answer. I'm longing so much, and have for such a long time. I'm so lonely, and now I've found comfort. In the mornings, we act normally. In the afternoons, too. Except now and then. But in the evenings, the suppressed longing of the entire day, the happiness and the bliss of all the times before come rushing to the surface, and all we can think about is each other. Every night, after our last kiss, I feel like running away and never looking him in the eyes again. Away, far away into the darkness and alone. And what awaits me at the bottom of those 14 stairs? Bright lights, questions, and laughter. I have to act normally and hope they don't notice anything. My heart is still too tender to be able to recover so quickly from a shock like the one I had last night. The gentle Anne makes infrequent appearances, and she's not about to let herself be shoved out the door so soon after she's arrived. Peter's reached a part of me that no one has ever reached before, except in my dream. He's taken hold of me and turned me inside out. Doesn't everyone need a little quiet time to put themselves to rights again? Oh, Peter, what have you done to me? What do you want from me? Where will this lead? Oh, now I understand Bep. Now that I'm going through it myself, I understand her doubts. If I were older,